Okay, so welcome. My name is John Beck, and I co-direct our daily work at Daily Lives. I'm sure that other people will come in, especially when they hear guitar and bass coming from this room. They'll know they're in the right place. Just some quick announcements, and then I'll introduce our duo this afternoon. Coming up next week, our own Michael Lee Sullivan from the MSU History Department will be doing our next brown bag next Thursday, co-sponsored by the African Studies Center. It's entitled Made of Muscle and Blood, Mine Workers of Clifton Morency, Arizona, in Kimberley, South Africa, 1880 to 1910. So Michael Lee has been doing research in both nations and on the ground in both places in relation to the experience of miners at that time in the primarily the diamond mines in South Africa and probably the copper mines, if I remember rightly, of Clifton Morency. Right before Thanksgiving, very interesting brown bag in our series. Well, actually, let me first say that that night on the 11th, it's Miner Day on campus because in this room, the film Salt of the Earth will be shown, and I'll just pass that around. But Christine Marin from Arizona State is an expert on the film. She will be here to talk about the film after, to lead the discussion of the film after it's shown. As I said to the group yesterday, Salt of the Earth probably is one of the few non-pornographic films ever banned by our government. And it was banned because of the fact that, number one, it was pro-labor. But number two, because a number of folks out of the Hollywood 10 who had been blacklisted by the U.S. government were connected to the film. It was also a film that involved the mine mill and smelter workers, which was one of the unions kicked out of the CIO based on their unwillingness to sign a non-communist pledge in terms of some of the leaders of the union and everything else. So it's a fascinating film. It's one of the first films probably in U.S. history that had strong women working-class characters as part of the film. So the specifically the leader of the women in support of the strike, Esperanza, do I remember? I think that's right. But do check it out. Do come next Thursday night for that. Then on November 22nd, Jennifer Bird, who's a prose poet, and Lad Stryer, a photographer, will be back across the street, by the way, for both the 11th during the day and the 22nd, will be here. And they have a book called The Daily Bread that looks at the experience of homelessness in Adrian in Lenawee County. And it's really a fascinating, fascinating little book and I think an important story to hear what it means to be without home and without work in the current environment. So please do come for that. Now let me get on to today, and what a pleasure. You know, we've had a wonderful relationship with the 10-pound fiddle for some time now. Sally Potter has been nice enough each year to sit down with me and to plan at least a concert or two a year where we can cooperate with the fiddle in terms of having their guest artists appear in our brown bag series, which I think is helpful to everyone concerned. James Keeligan has been a well-known folk singer, not necessarily always simply thought of as Canadian, because much of his work, I think, really spans more than just, quote-unquote, the Canadian experience. But we're very happy to have the MSU Canadian Studies Center as a co-sponsor of this specific thing. You know, I was raised in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is often confused with part of Canada. And I have to tell the story. I think that my colleague Julie knows the story, that when I was with the Paper Workers Union, one of my colleagues, we were in Duluth, Minnesota, and it was 30 below zero. And we were walking the streets of Duluth, Minnesota, and suddenly he stopped in the middle of the street, just stopped dead. He had been raised in North Carolina. And he looked at me and says, John, do you realize there's an entire nation north of us? And I said, yes, I do. And so I think that we have at times a kind of a gray amorphous understanding of Canada, I think people believe at times that Canadians are sort of like us, only a little different or whatever. But Canadian labor is one of those things that often fades totally into obscurity. The fact that there are unions in Canada, many of our international unions here in the United States share Canadian membership. That's why we're called international unions, in my case, the Steelworkers Union now. But that connection between Canada and the United States and the Western United States and Western Canada, the border was virtually meaningless to a lot of loggers and others who worked in that part of the world. And the industrial workers of the world, truly the first truly international labor union, had strong Canadian membership as well as strong U.S. membership in the earliest part of the 20th century. So James Keeligan and David Woodhead are here to tell us in song and in word about Small Rebellions, Canadian Labor in Song. So please help me in welcoming them to our Brown Bag series.
I wouldn't be a Canadian if I didn't start with a couple of apologies. first one is on a physical nature. I am having some health problems. I've got a couple of compressed discs in the upper part of my neck, which have tapped onto a nerve, which has rendered this hand largely numb. So my guitar playing is not up to standard. But David covers a host of things. So
I'll make as much noise as possible.
He will. And so it also means that there's a couple of tunes that I absolutely can't play because my hand won't play them. Unfortunately, one of them is the title track of the seminar. And the other apology is that although I've written a lot about history and a lot about labor history, I am by no means a labor historian. And I'm by no means an expert on the subject of labor. What I do is I write songs about ordinary people in generally extraordinary circumstances, and a lot of times that turns out to be labor history. And I'll explain the backstories of some of the songs, how I come to write the stories of these people in those fashions, and then I hope that you'll have some questions and some proddings and whatnot. And this I'll start with a set of actually sort of three songs that are kind of related. The first one is a song that I wrote called Boom Gone to Bust. I grew up in Calgary, up in Western Canada, which is an oil town, and very subject to the boom and bust cycle. And I watched many of them come and go, and started to think about the fact that the nature of a lot of Canadian labor is about an east-west movement across the country. As things go bust in one part of the country, people go east to find work, and then when they go bust in the east, they come west to find work. And there's just this well-beaten path back and forth between the two. And this song uses as the metaphor in the beginning of the On to Ottawa trek, which was in the midst of the Depression in 1935, workers started to abandon the labor camps in central British Columbia, the logging camps and labor camps that the government had set up. They basically boarded trains, freight trains, and headed on to have a demonstration in Ottawa, and it was called the On to Ottawa Trek. Thousands and thousands of guys boarded the trains. They were finally hauled off the trains, and there was a riot in Regina. They barely got halfway to Ottawa before the truck was stopped. And so that shows up as sort of the metaphor that sets this movement up in the song. And this is a song called Boom Gone to Bust. Started east sometime in the 30s with the On to Ottawa men. He'd enough of the camps and the dole and the handouts. He wanted to work and to tie the loose ends. He drifted from factory to foundry to flophouse, the war sorted out what mere men could not. In Sudbury's forges he worked like a madman, those years lost to hunger Dad never forgot. And I headed west when I had turned 20, when the factories and foundries had closed. And in my mind's eye, I thought I might settle out here where my father was raised and was born. I worked as a jug hound, a roughneck, a bouncer. I worked where I wanted. I drew damn good pay. Son, I went to our luck, and so we just pushed it till OPEC and mortgages ate it away. Now the boom's gone to bust and we're down on the doughboys. No treasure laid up but family and friends. It's pull up stakes now or pull up stakes later. For a laboring man, the road never ends. Well, it seems to me somehow this nation of migrants, father to daughter, from mother to son, would constantly shift from the east or the west till we run out of work or of places to run. Gone now the days when you lived with your parents and their parents before them were bred and were born. Let's go where the work is to live any life at all. Bend like a willow to weather the storm. Now the boom's gone to bust and we're down on the doughboys. No treasure laid up but family and friends. It's pull up stakes now or pull up stakes later. For laboring man, the road never ends. Yes, the boom's gone to bust and we're down on the doughboys. For a laboring man, the road never ends. Thank you. Harvest. Okay. So, coming from the other side now, there's this song. It's a traditional tune from Prince Edward Island about the days when they used to run trains from the Maritimes out to the Western provinces. And they called them harvest trains. They brought thousands of guys out to work on the wheat harvest in Saskatchewan and Alberta. And this is a traditional song, like I said, from Prince Edward Island. That I learned off the late lamented Joan McIsaac. And for some reason in the song, Prince Edward Island is referred to as the land of the golden pelt. And I don't really know why. Possibly there was some sort of indigenous toupee-making industry on the island. If there was, it's long since gone. If you look at any aerial photograph of Prince Edward Island, there are no toupees in existence. But it says in the song, there's no place here where there is such cheer as the land of the golden pelt. And singing this song, thinking about these guys coming from Nova Scotia and New Brunswick and Prince Edward Island out west to find work, reminded me of my time in the first oil boom in Calgary, where the place was filled with Newfoundlanders. It was the largest number of Newfoundlanders outside of Newfoundland existed in Calgary. tens of thousands of them came out to work because there was no work to be had in Newfoundland. And in this latest oil boom, if you go up to Fort McMurray, where the oil sands project is, if you go up to the tar sands project, you'll find that almost everybody working on that project is from Newfoundland, so much so that they had to add planes. The Western Canadian airline company WestJet added a route that went directly from Fort McMurray to St. John's, Newfoundland, in order to accommodate the oil workers. And I find it funny that you're singing a traditional song about these trains bringing these guys out, and now it's planes flying them back and forth. And seeing an interview on with a family in Newfoundland, and the daughter saying that she misses her father. She misses her father because he leaves on Sunday night, and he's away for the whole week, and he comes back on Friday night. And thinking about the guy in this song who's actually gone for 3 months at a time. This is a song called Harvest Train. Listen to the whistle of the train. We're pulling from the station to the land of the golden grain. And when we return again, our friends will drink our health. 'Cause there's no place here where there is such cheer as the land of the golden pelt. Dear, I greatly fear that soon I will be gone. I am going away on a harvest train to the far Saskatchewan to reap the grain on a western plain where the buffalo used to roam. And I'll leave you alone in your island home, my dear Colleen Bond. Molly, dear, when night is near and I am far away, with a loving heart you'll do your part and for me you will pray. When the kids are fed, they go to bed and you'll stand out on the lawn. And you will heave a sigh for your absent boy in the far Saskatchewan. You'll do your part and for me you will pray. And nevermore I'll go a sore to the far Saskatchewan, or I'll leave you here, my Molly dear, in your little island home. Listen to the whistle of the train. We're pulling from the station and we're homeward bound again. And when we return again, our friends will drink our health. 'Cause there's no place here where there is such cheer as the land of the golden pelt. Land of the golden pelt.
Trilogy?
A
Okay. Oh, yeah.
No charts.
No charts. No, no.
This is just because we were sort of on a railway theme in the first two songs. We just finished on Saturday night. We played a gig with the Hamilton Philharmonic Orchestra, and kind of strange to be playing with a Philharmonic Orchestra now being here. But
come on in, you guys. Come on.
But one of the songs that we arranged for the orchestra was this next one. Just the theme of the orchestra show was all about stories and me doing all the story songs in one place. But I wanted to give pride of place to a song that really was the one that inspired me to start writing. Was one of the things that inspired me to start writing about history and about songs. And it's this one, and it's a Gordon Lightfoot tune. And it's got a labor relation. There was a time in this fair land when the railroad did not run, when the wild majestic mountains stood alone against the sun. Long before the white man and long before the wheel, when the green dark forest was too silent to be real. But time has no beginnings and history has no bounds. As to this verdant country, they came from all around. They worked upon our waterways and they walked the forest tall. Built the mines, the mills, and the factories for the good of us all. And when the young man's fancy was turning to the spring, and the railroad men grew restless for to hear the hammers ring, their minds were overflowing with the visions of their day. And many a fortune lost and won, and many a debt to pay. For they looked to the future and watered the sea. They saw an iron road running from the sea to the sea, bringing the goods from the young growing land, all up from the seaports and into their hands. Look away, said they, across this mighty land, from the eastern shores to the western strands, bringing workers and bringing the rails, gotta lay down the tracks and tear up the trails. Open her heart, let the lifeblood flow. Gotta get on our way, cause we're moving too slow. Bringing the workers and bringing the rails. Lay down the tracks and tear up the trails. Open her heart, let the lifeblood flow. Gotta get on our way, cause we're moving too slow. Get on our way, cause we're moving too slow. Across the blue Rockies, the sun is declining. The stars, they come stealing at the close of the day. Across the wide prairies, our loved ones lie sleeping. Beyond the dark ocean, in a place far away. And we are the navvies who work upon the railway, swinging our hammers in the bright blazing sun, laying down tracks and building the bridges. Then now long days are done. And we are the navvies who work upon the railway, swinging our hammers in the bright blazing sun, living on stew and drinking bad whiskey, bending our backs till the railroad is done. So over the mountains and over the plains, into the muskeg and into the rains, up the St. Lawrence all the way to Gaspé, swinging our hammers and drawing our pay, laying the men, tying them down, way to the bunkhouse and into the town. A dollar a day and a place for my head, a drink to the living, a toast to the dead. Oh, the song of the future has been sung, all the battles have been won. On the mountain tops we stand, all the world at our command. We have opened up the soil with our teardrops and our toil. Oh, there was a time in this fair land when the railroad did not run, when the wild, majestic mountains stood alone against the sun. Long before the white man and long before the wheel, when the green, dark forest was too silent to be real, when the green, dark forest was too silent to be real, and many other dead men too silent to be real, and many are dead men too silent to be real. Thank you. Thank you. A highly romanticized version of things, I'm sure you'll agree. But in actual fact, when you're talking about Canadian labor history and its perception, and the perception of Canadian labor, I think, amongst Canadians themselves, that's the sort of thing that comes to mind, is the building of the railway and the navvies. And you might get to talk about the Chinese laborers at some point. You might not. I had sort of a different view of Canadian labor. And this next song is sort of indicative of that. And it comes out of a conversation that I had with a good friend of ours named Bobby Watt. And Bobby Watt is a fantastic singer and songwriter in his own right, but where Bobby makes his living is as a stonemason. And I remember reading an article in Harper's, I think about 5 or 6 years ago, that was talking about disappearing skills. And, you know, they mentioned the fact that there's really nobody left who can build a barrel out of wooden staves, that these skills, as they get lost, just are not replaced. And it mentioned in the course of the article that there's probably about 20 people left on the face of the earth that could build you a cathedral. And, in fact, one of those 20 people is Bobby Watt, because that's what Bobby works in, is in large stone. And he's spent the past, amongst his other things, refurbishing cathedrals, you know, in Puerto Rico, refurbishment of the roof of Carnegie Hall, which he was called in to do. And when he negotiated that contract with him, he negotiated 2 hours of stage time in addition to the stonework. But his biggest project
did
has been...
Did he sell tickets?
He didn't sell tickets. He just wanted 2 hours on stage singing. He's a very large Scottish guy, as you'd expect a stonemason to be, and hands, you know, the size of this guitar. But his main project over the past 10 or 15 years has been the refurbishment of the Canadian Parliament buildings, which are in constant need of work. And Bobby told me the story of this next, or gave me the kernel of the story for this next song. The Canadian Parliament buildings burned in 1916, and you all know that because you're all devotees of Canadian history. And you probably know that the fire started... Okay, in the library. Specifically in the Senate library, and it was started by a sleeping senator and a smoking cigar. And not much of a surprise, really, that there was more spark in the cigar than the senator. But because the fire happened in February, they had to pour so much water on the building that the water got into the mortar between the stones, which meant that the mortar was going to crack. And the only way to save the building was basically to tear it down and then rebuild it, which is what they did. They rebuilt it according to the original plan. The only thing that they changed was they added a tower on the front, which we now call the Peace Tower, because they were rebuilding the Parliament buildings in the middle of World War I, basically. And the tower was added to the front to honor the fallen of World War I. And Bobby told me that because of that, there were no apprentices that worked on the job. All the guys of apprentice age were off fighting the war in France. So all the guys that worked on the building were master masons, which speaks to the high quality of the building. But they had one guy in particular. When you go to the Parliament buildings, as you walk through the Parliament buildings, you'll occasionally find a face staring at you out of an unexpected corner. Or in you know a lintel over here, or on top of a doorway over there. They had one mason who had a little tent set off to the side, and his job over the whole course of the project was to carve the face of every man that worked on the building into the building. And so as you walk through the building, the faces of the workers actually look at you from various secret corners and whatnot, which I think is an amazing thing in the halls of power. That was the story that Bobby laid on me, and out of that I wove this particular thing. And I'll tell you a little something at the end of the song about storytelling and whatnot. The song, however, starts in Toronto, and when they were building the provincial legislature in Toronto, they brought the stonemasons in first, and they gave them a street in what is now downtown Toronto, and they sent them to the quarry, and they gave them the pick of the rock of the quarry, and they said, build your own houses. And they did. They built this beautiful lane of stone cottages called Stonecutter's Lane. And then the guys went back, and they got some more stone, and they built themselves a pub up the top end, which they called the Stonecutter's Arms. And so the song starts in Toronto in Stonecutter's Lane, but ends up in Ottawa. And so this is a song called Stonecutter. If you're down by Queen and Britain streets, you'll find Stonecutter's Lane, the house that my grandfather built, where I was born and raised. And my granddad was a mason, and my father in his time. When my time came, I signed as an apprentice lad. Now the early 1900s were a rich, fat afternoon. We were cutting stone like demons, and no work was done too soon. And we were hired out on 7 jobs, and so to take the slack, we put out advertisements for apprentice lads. Thank you. Never seen a better crew. Yeah, they knew what work was. Cornices and lintels, they laid stone like they were gods. And to hear the hammers ring out, you'd think it was a song. In August 1914, in the sultry summer heat, they took a vote in Ottawa, and the drums began to beat. Honor, glory, I saw them. The story doesn't change. To a man they all enlisted my apprentice lad. And I couldn't say that I agreed, 'cause I knew what war was. It was worker killing worker for some politician's cause. But off to battle they all marched. They gassed them at Cambrai. The dogs of war had done for my apprentice lad. In 1916, fire broke out. Parliament was raised. The call went out for masons to rebuild and to relay. It was the contract of a lifetime, the house upon the hill. And so they came out from Vancouver, and they came down from Montreal. Master masons, everyone, yeah, they were answering their call. But there was no man under 30, no man whose work I didn't know. The fields of France had swallowed the apprentice lad. And it's 1921 now, and I'm standing at the peak, about to cap the peace tower off, 'cause no one here can speak. And the mortar for that stone we mixed with clay from Flanders fields, and laid it in its place for those apprentice lads. And we laid it in its place for those apprentice lads. When I played that song the first time for Bobby ran a folk club in Whitby, Ontario, on top of everything else, on top of being a mason and a singer and a songwriter. And he came up to me at the break, and he walked up to me, and he says, "You never told me you'd been a mason." And I said, "Well, I've never been a mason." He goes, "How did you know about mixing clay with the mortar in order to make it set faster?" I said, "I guessed." He goes, "How did you know about the clay from Flanders?" I said, "I guessed." And he winked at me and walked away. When writing about history, when taking a story from history and writing about it, one of the things that I encourage my songwriting students to do is to take the bare minimum of facts that you can and create the character and let the character speak to you. I let that character speak to me, and it seemed the logical thing that they would do when they hit the top of that tower and put the last stone in would be that they would get clay from Flanders, from a battlefield in Flanders, in order to set that stone. It just seemed logical to me, and as it turns out, that's exactly what they did. Those masons had clay from Flanders sent over so that they could set that last stone in honor of their workers who died in France. So When, like I say, I tell that to my songwriting students, I just basically encourage all of you, if you're writing history and you're writing it from that fictional point of view, is to let your character take it as far as the character will go, and you're probably going to end up being right. Hopefully. If not, there's always revision. And let's do Torres. I'm sometimes referred to as the master of disaster, because there is a lot of death and destruction in my songs. But this next song, too, has a story connected to it, and it's about a more recent sort of labor tragedy. This is a song about a ship called the Captain Torres, and in December 1989, the Torres was heading along the, through the Cabot Straits towards the St. Lawrence River, heading towards Montreal. There was an incredibly bad storm blowing, and the Torres had lost engines and was bobbing around like a cork out in the straits. And they radioed into the Canadian Coast Guard, said that they were in trouble. The Canadian Coast Guard radioed back and said there was nothing they could do to help them. The storm was so bad they couldn't get the helicopters up. There was no ship anywhere near them. They were told to try and ride it out, and they tried to ride it out, but then the Torres was hit by a rogue wave. She split along her keel, and she started to go down. They realized that there was no chance of survival in the lifeboats, and that the ship was heading to the bottom, and there was no rescue. And so the captain radioed back into Sydney and said, there is something you can do for us. And for the next hour and a half, they patched the ship's radio through the phone lines. And all 29 crew members lined up in the radio room, and everybody made a two-minute phone call home to say goodbye. And there's several amazing things about that to me. One, these guys in the last hour and a half of their lives, what did they do? Did they fall to infighting? Did they try and figure out some way to screw one another over? No. They lined up calmly in a radio room, and everybody took their appointed 2 minutes and phoned the people that they loved above all else. And that, to me, is an amazing comment on the human condition. Then two things happened with this song for me. One, I was playing at the Stan Rogers Festival in Canso, Nova Scotia, and I had just finished a workshop. I was sort of standing off by the side of the stage, and these six guys approached me, and they were big and they were burly. And the one in the front of the group sort of walked up to me, and he poked at me, and he went, "You're Keelahan?" And I went, "Yeah." He goes, "You wrote the song about the Torres?" And I said, "Yep." And he reached behind, and somebody handed him a cap, and he handed me this cap, and it said, "Coast Guard Station, Sydney, Nova Scotia." And they handed me the cap, and they said, "That was a fine song." And then he handed me a tape, which I've never listened to. And the tape is the tape from that night. And I just have never been able to bring myself to listen to the tape. Shortly after that, I was down in Australia, and I played this song at the Woodford Folk Festival. About 3 weeks after I got back, I got an email from this woman who had said that she'd seen my performance at Woodford, and she'd seen that song, and the song had just struck her incredibly, and she'd gone home to Bellingen, where she lived in New South Wales, and the neighbors came over the night after she got back from the festival, because she always came back with boxes of CDs, and the neighbors always came in to see what was new, and they asked what she'd enjoyed, and she mentioned me, and then she started explaining about this song, and she said there was something eerily familiar about the song, she said, and I couldn't put my hand on it, and as she was explaining the song, one of her neighbors put her hand on hers and said, "The reason why it's familiar is because I'm the widow of the captain." And in one strange little line, the song ended up in Kate Valeska's hands. She wrote me a letter. She was 6 months pregnant at the time that the ship went down. So her daughter never knew her father. And her husband, the captain, was so busy on the bridge trying to keep the ship afloat as long as he could so that everybody could make their phone calls that he never made his own. And she said, you know, I'd sent her down a disc and a letter saying that it was not my intention ever to sort of capitalize on the memory of those men. And when she wrote back, she said, I'm putting the CD away. She said, I read the lyrics and I can't listen to the song. I've put the CD away for my daughter, who is now 11 years old, and hopefully someday she'll be able to listen to it. She said, but I can't. And so it's in addition to that thing I said about letting the fictional characters take their way all the way through the story, sometimes if you write the story, the story just sort of goes out and multiplies itself. And it's odd because I wrote this song when I was searching for the voice that I was going to write this song from. I wrote it from the point of view of one of the women at home. And I'd had the story rolling around in my head for a long time, and I'd been looking for some way to write it. And I read an account. I got an account of one of the families going out to lay a wreath on the Cabot Straits in memory of one of their sons. And as the guy throws the wreath onto the water, he says, La mer ne pardonne pas, the sea forgives not. And that became the chorus to this tune. And we'll do it without the outro.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
How small the Captain Torres, how high the sea, and gale 10 and engines failing, no quarter, no lee, and they know when the wrong wave hits them, perdu, they're gone. They've played their share of poker. They know odds are long. La mer ne pardonne pas. La mer ne pardonne pas. And time yet for consolation. Each makes one call. The signals came, ship to shore. Words plucked from the squall, and his heart a deep, deep ocean. His voice so small, so faint through all the static. Five words, that's all. La mer ne pardonne pas. La mer ne pardonne pas. Do I count myself lucky that I was home? The phone was ringing, and what of others' wives who missed it? Came home to red lights blinking. How strange this world of wonder, and ships sailing and planes flying and sound sent at speed of light. Phone calls from young men dying, and these walls bought and paid for by labor on board. Gone months to clothe and feed us, gone now forevermore. La mer ne pardonne pas, 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 la mer ne pardonne
we have time for another couple. And is there anything you'd like to say? Add, question?
I don't think anyone wants to stop you. Keep on, and we'll just see how long we can keep you going, and then we'll open it up for
money. Okay, well, we'll play. No worries. We'll play two more for you. Then one strictly a labor song, and then the other is a new song that's sort of an anthem for our times, I think. And the reason why I started writing the historical ballads and stuff, aside from wasting time before I had to turn term papers in and things, was that so much of our history in Canada is unsung and unwritten. And we've just gotten back from a tour in England where you can't walk a step without, you know, it's almost like each brick in the street has a song or a poem or a book about it, you know. And I grew up, like I said, in Calgary in Western Canada, and I worked one summer down in the Crow's Nest Pass, which is right down in the very southwest corner of the province, and it's an old coal mining area. And I kept driving by in this little town called Hillcrest. I kept driving by this little thing called the Hillcrest Memorial Graveyard. And one day, and, you know, granted, take into account, I'm a guy who's reasonably aware of history. And I'm from an Irish family where history is all important. And I went in one day to the Hillcrest Memorial Graveyard to find out, you know, what was in the Hillcrest Memorial Graveyard, and found these two mass graves that are the final resting place for the 189 men and boys that were the victims of Canada's largest mining disaster, which happened 90 miles from my home, and which I'd never heard about. I'd never heard about the Hillcrest mine disaster, never heard a song, haven't seen a book, nary a movie, not a poem, nothing. And this ramshackle graveyard with two common graves in which there's 189 men and boys. And
So I started to find out about the Hillcrest Mine disaster and wrote this song, which is not, you know, historically about the song, about the disaster itself, but is trying to sum up what the feeling was in the Crow's Nest Pass after the disaster happened, which was pretty close to rebellion. It was so close to rebellion. Within 6 months of the Hillcrest Mine disaster happening, two of the townships in the Crow's Nest Pass had elected communist mayors, and the government was pretty damn worried about what was going on. And if it hadn't have been for the eruption of World War I, probably there would have been a coal war in southern Alberta, the likes of which happened in West Virginia in this country. And but like I say, nary a word. And so I wrote this song. And a couple of years ago, I got a call from the Frank Slide Interpretive Center, which runs the historical stuff for the Crow's Nest Pass. And they had, over the past few years, raised the money to refurbish the graveyard. And they asked me to come down and play the song at the rededication of the graveyard. And when I walked back into that graveyard where I'd written this song, I didn't recognize it. A monument at the entrance to the thing, a huge plinth explaining what the disaster was all about. And around the two common graves, a railing now with the name of every single man and what their job was in the mine on that railing. And so this is the Hillcrest Mine. Down in the mines of the Crow's Nest Pass, the men that sigh in labor, sweating coal from the womb of the pit, the smell of life they savor. And in that mine, young man, you'll find a wealth of broken dreams, as long and as dark and as black and as wide as the coal in the Hillcrest seam. Say you don't go.
Say you don't go.
Say you don't go down in the Hillcrest mine, and say you don't go.
Say you don't go.
Say you don't go down in the Hillcrest mine, 'cause it's a one short step you might leave this world behind. Say you don't go, say you don't go down in the Hillcrest mine. Well, I've heard it whispered in the light of dawn that mountains sometimes moves, that boat's ill for the morning shift, you know what you're gonna lose. Don't go, my son, where the deep coal runs. Turn your back on the mine on the hill. 'Cause if the dust and the dark and the gas don't get you, then the goons or the bosses will. Say you don't go.
Say you don't go.
Say you don't go down in the Hillcrest mine, and say you don't go.
Say you don't go.
Say you don't go down in the Hillcrest mine, 'cause it's a one short step you might leave this world behind. Say I don't go, say I don't go down in the Hillcrest mine. And they say I don't go. Well, son, I'm gonna open up. I'm gonna have my say. You'll get no peace from the Hillcrest mines, the peace of an early grave. But go out and work for the workers' rights. Go work for the workers' needs. Don't stay down here to toil for your buck, to be a tool for the owner's greed. Say you don't go.
Say you don't go.
Say you don't go down in the Hillcrest mine, and say you don't go.
Say you don't go.
Say you don't go down in the Hillcrest mine, 'cause it's a one short step you might leave this world behind. Say you don't go. Say you don't go down in the Hillcrest mine, and say you don't go. Say you don't go down in the Hillcrest
last night, and they say I don't go. Say I don't go down in the Hillcrest of mine, cause it's a one short step. You might leave this world behind. Say I don't go, say I don't go down in the Hillcrest of mine.
Thank you.
And we'll just leave you with this one, and then if you have anything, any questions or anything after this, then feel free. This is the title track off the new CD. And
you can always come to the concert tonight.
I was just about to get there. David and I are playing tonight at the 10 Pound Fiddle at the Unitarian Universalist Church. It's at 8:55. And this is David Woodhead, by the way.
All right. Thanks.
Easy credit, no money down. That's the way that we built this town. On a banker's ledger, we watched it rise. A house of cards and a pack of lies. A house of cards and a pack of lies. Rung by rung, we raise the stakes. You bend the rules and the ladder breaks. We'd all get wealthy, but would we ever get wise? To the house of cards and the pack of lies. A house of cards and a pack of lies. They sold you plastic, then took your ace. With suits and ties and the Joker's face. And now there's nowhere left to hide but a house of cards and a pack of lies. A house of cards and a pack of lies. Yeah. When the times were easy, we did the deal. We placed our bets and they spun the wheel. And we should have known that there was no prize but a house of cards and a pack of lies. A house of cards and a pack of lies. Smoke and mirrors and the market crash. We burnt a town to stone and ash. We lit the fires of our own demise in the house of cards and the pack of lies. A house of cards and a pack of lies. We bought that dream and we sold it on, but it ain't worth nothing now the money's gone. And the only shelter that credit buys is a house of cards and a pack of lies. A house of cards and a pack of lies.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to open up for questions in a minute, but there are sign-in sheets that are still floating around. James has CDs available. The new CD is available, House of Cards, right?
Yep.
And so that's available up here after we're all
tonight. You have to pay for that. You didn't have to pay for this. But I think if you're not out of James Keeler Gang again, please do come to, yet if you've not had enough, I know you don't, so come tonight to the Philly. So open it up for questions or comments. Questions or comments?
Complaints?
Or have we covered everything so effectively?
Oh, thanks.
I heard you. Right. Your voices are just outstanding. They go with the music.
Thank you.
It's just terrific. Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thanks.
Back to you, Laurie. I see your hand up.
I'm just at the beginning, so maybe you said something to this effect, but I'm curious about, since you've seen so many songs dealing with history and stories you say that haven't been told, is your work used by educators? Is there some sort of mechanism by which this is a website or this is where...
And would you repeat the question, by the way, for the microphone?
Well, I think so, and thank you for saying that. And in Canada in particular, my stuff is used in schools a lot. And the basic mechanism is a teacher will write to me and say, "Can I use this song?" And I'll say, "Certainly." And because I don't. And if they heard the song and they sort of want the CD, I'll send the CD along. Anything that furthers the education about history, anything that furthers education about history, I'm all for. So, like I say, the mechanism is they contact me, I give them the stuff, they teach. I've gone into classrooms occasionally in order to sort of do a live element of it. And I've gotten a lot of stuff back from kids who have actually gone on and studied some of the things deeper. In particular, I've got a song about the Japanese internment in Canada, which seems to have affected a lot of people. And I get a lot of stuff back from students who have used that song as sort of an entrance into addressing issues of you know, racism and our society.
Just to follow up on that, what is it about the Canadian culture that would account for the lack of historical
record? I think there's sort of a natural reticence in us. I think we're overshadowed media-wise, certainly by what goes on down here. And in terms of the overwhelmingness of the media from down here, in terms of film and television and books, that tends to overwhelm our own sort of pop culture sense of our own history. I think that's probably the largest factor. Then the other thing is, like I say, just sort of this natural Canadian reticence that we just don't feel like there's anything really worthwhile in our history that can compare with things like, you know, Custer's Last Stand or the Civil War, or, you know, like when sort of placed up against the way that history is written and presented down here, our history does indeed seem kind of small. And not only here, but, that, you know, when I was growing up, we were still a dominion, and so you had to put our history against the history of the British Empire, you know. And
I think that's a good point, because I grew up with Meccano, like not Erector, you know, like the American, you know, toys. And I had the magazines from Britain. And so I think that has changed. I don't think the kids these days really have that amount of influence from the British Empire. But going to the UK, and we just got back from a tour there, there's all these familiar buttons being pushed in my brain, probably more than you know, the equivalent for a U.S. person.
And just a quick commercial. Do remember that our amnesia about American labor history, the history of workers generally, I think is probably just as strong in the United States, and we always have to fight against that issue here. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily that same way across the globe, whether it's Britain or Sweden or South Africa or various places that do it differently. I have a question here and then in the back.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
Okay, and Ben?
I was just kind of responding to what you were saying. My daughter, who is now 31, after her freshman year in college, went to do 20th century archaeology in the site of the Colorado Coal Field Wars. And when she told me what she was going to dig up, I said, the what? I had never heard of it. I grew up in coal country in Pennsylvania, and I had never heard of the Colorado Coal Field Wars.
Yeah.
But we're just as ignorant here, really.
But I, part of my response when people, because people will come up and they'll go, you know, I was never taught that in school. And my response is always, why did you think you would be?
Yeah.
You know, because schools, you know, are overloaded enough. And when they have to sort of pick and choose history, they're going to give a broad scope. What I hope to do through what I do and working with other songwriters and whatnot is to give people the tools to go out and write their own history. Because that's the real key here. The real key is that we start writing our own history. We start singing our own songs about our own history. And then we are less dependent on the craft that gets, you know, sort of shoveled down towards us. And as long as we start telling our stories and in that, you know, in whatever way we can, that's how people start learning about the Colorado Coal Wars. And that's how they start learning about the Hillcrest Mine. That's how they start learning about all these things. It's by us writing the history and telling it.
Great, and just thank you for mentioning Ludlow, because we all know it is the Ludlow Massacre.
I had never even heard the Woody Guthrie song at that point.
And the just to put a historical Michigan frame on it for a second, a few months in advance of the Ludlow Massacre, 74 people died in Calumet.
That's right.
When fire was called in a striker's Christmas party, where the majority of those were children who perished when they could not get out of the hall and smothered on the stairs when they were stacked like horribly. A few months later in Ludlow, I believe 14 people or 16 people were killed, one mother and I believe 15 children who were in a tent village when it was mowed down, in that case, by federal troops.
Right.
So, there's a lot of history that is all around us, I think, as to James' point, that we know nothing about until you happen to run into that graveyard or trip over a memorial that might be somewhere else. So thank you for raising it. Yes?
Yeah, I think in Michigan, nothing of labor history is taught here, even though at one point by now the unions were very strong, but they made no effort to put it in suit. We were in Australia several years ago and went to the town of Broken Hill, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the most amazing town I've ever been in, because entire town celebrates its labor history. You go into the tourist office, and there's this huge mural of the strikes that they had.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, it's amazing in Australia that their appreciation of labor history. It's amazing again in the UK. You get up around Durham and Sutherland. You get up into the northeast, and the awareness of labor history and the importance of unions is just everywhere around you. You know, it's stunning. And to me, the like you say, the amnesia, you know, that people don't realize they work an 8-hour day because you know, eight guys were hanged in Chicago.
Right.
You know, they don't realize we work a 40-hour week because people suffered and bled and died for that. You know, and like I say, just any kind of history that we can retell is important. But labor history, you know, is certainly something that has to be retold.
Well, join me in thanking them one more time.
Thank you.
Do come next Thursday to hear Michael Lee Sullivan talk about South Africa and Arizona. Come Monday the 22nd to hear about homelessness in Adrian. Thank you so much for coming. If you haven't signed in, sign in. And remember those wonderful CDs up here for sale.